Father in heaven, thank you for being willing to speak to us when it comes to matters not only of the heart, but matters of our lifestyle. Thank you that you're trying to lead us to a closer relationship with you, and you don't want anything in our lives to impair that ability. Please help us in that regard to study together this afternoon. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we're beginning a 5-part series on the brain and how to improve cognitive function. For those of you who weren't with us yesterday, I told you that I was going to continue a presentation I began yesterday because it has such profound implications as far as brain health. We were speaking some about the Methuselah factor or hemorheology. How many of you were not here when I spoke about blood fluidity and hemorheology? Okay, let me give you just a quick overview. Hemorheology is the science of blood fluidity. You see the word up there, hemorheology. If we can improve blood fluidity, the research shows us that we improve cognitive function. Your brain works better if your blood is flowing more fluidly. Now you'd say, well, that should be pretty obvious because the way the brain works is based on getting raw materials like glucose from the blood and oxygen. And if you can't get those things delivered optimally to the brain, performance will suffer. And that's indeed what we see. So we went through some of that material on Sunday, yesterday. And we also observed that those very same things that improve blood fluidity not only improve cognitive function, but will decrease your risk of cognitive robbers like stroke, heart disease, and other things that you may not think of having a bearing on mental health because they don't, like vision, glaucoma, and macular degeneration. Your risk of those conditions are decreased if your blood is more fluid, if your hemorheology is better. So with that preliminary background, we want to speak in detail about the 10 things I mentioned to the group that can improve blood fluidity and enhance cognitive performance. We're going to look at that in this presentation. Then tomorrow, we're going to look at other areas, other things that are lifestyle-related that affect brain health, and we'll go from there. So we talked yesterday about the value of donating blood in improving hemorheology, blood fluidity. Most Americans actually have more blood than they need. They have too many blood cells, a higher hematocrit. That means a higher percentage of the blood made up of red blood cells than is optimal. Now, if you're anemic, you're not one of those people that would benefit from having being a blood donor. But blood donation has actually been shown to improve cognitive function. Drink more water. This is critical in improving blood fluidity. And I showed this slide to some of you yesterday afternoon. I just want to take a little time with it because this is actually from the Seventh-day Adventist Health Study. Back in 2002... Dr. Jacqueline Chan and her colleagues there at Loma Linda looked at the Adventist Health Study 1 data. That's not the current ongoing AHS, but the previous one. And they were looking at correlations, connections between fluid intake and death from heart attack. And what you see here is that for both men and women, risk of dying from a heart attack cut roughly in half by drinking more water. And this is comparing greater than 5 glasses a day with less than 2 glasses of water. If you think whatever beverage you're drinking is just as good as water, they weren't able to separate or stratify all the different beverages. They just had to lump them all together, other beverages. And when they looked at Seventh-day Adventists and their use of other beverages, instead of decreasing their risk of dying of a heart attack, it increased the risk. So granted, you can't necessarily say that you shouldn't drink chamomile tea based on this data because they didn't look specifically at it. But if you look at most of the beverages that we're consuming as Adventists that are not water, they're actually hurting us and they're not helping us. Well, let's talk a little bit more about water and blood fluidity as well as brain health in general. Obesity is a condition that is rampant in America. When you're overweight, especially around the middle, you're producing bioactive compounds that actually can affect your body in a multitude of ways. Some of those compounds can affect your metabolism, and they do affect your metabolism. So weight loss actually can help you in a number of respects, and drinking water actually can help you lose weight. So this is not a gimmick. This is actually true. This is published in one of the endocrinology journals. Boschman and his colleagues actually observed something very interesting, and that was if you drink 500 cc's, a half liter, roughly a pint of water, what will happen is if it's pure water, so no mineral water, it's not mineral water, it's not herb tea, your metabolism will rise about 24% for 1 hour. So you actually are burning more calories in the hour after drinking those 500 cc's of water. Now you say, well, how do you know other water wouldn't do it? Well, they actually did it. They gave some mineral water. We call it isoosmolar or isoosmotic saline. So it's just like your body concentration. And that had no effect. There's something to do with this difference in concentration of substances in the water. When the water has nothing in it, when it's just pure water, it has this weight loss effect. Whereas if you put things in it, it does not have that effect. And smaller amounts of water, you see, also did not do it. You see the technical term for it in the description in the journal, the article title. Water drinking induces thermogenesis. What that literally means is it actually increases the burning of calories by the body. So that's what they observed. And they say it's through osmosensitive mechanisms. I tried to explain what that is. That's through having things that are very low concentration, like pure water. Well, water will help you in other ways as well. So there are benefits beyond just the mental health and blood fluidity benefits, constipation, diabetic complications, high blood pressure, urinary infections, kidney stones, and gallbladder disease. All are decreased if you drink more water. So how much water should you drink? What do you think? How much water? Well, at least 5 glasses in that research. Many of you have heard the figure 8 to 10 glasses of water. One rule of thumb we sometimes use is take your ideal weight, divide it in half, and drink that number of ounces of water. Now, some of you may prefer to use your actual weight rather than your ideal weight. But the reason we say ideal weight is that we've had patients, some of the centers where I've worked, who weigh over 600 pounds. I mean, if they did that calculation, I mean, they'd be approaching, 3 gallons of water a day. 128 ounces in a gallon. But here's the point. If you're worried about drinking too much water, did you hear here at this camp meeting how much water is too much? The research indicates that for a healthy person on no medications, the amount of water that it would take to dangerously affect your sodium level. If you drink too much water, you can get something called hyponatremia. That's where you wash the sodium out of your body. And the research suggests it takes 4 to 5 gallons a day. So most of you, if you said, did I have my 8 glasses or not? I don't want to have that extra glass. I don't want to die from hyponatremia. No, this is not a realistic fear. Now, it's different if you're running in a marathon in the heat. You understand that. There are people that have died when you're losing sodium. Drinking just pure water with no electrolytes can be dangerous. But most of you, even if you're exercising in the heat, do not need to take in extra sodium. It will actually interfere with the weight loss benefits that we showed you and will also interfere with the blood pressure lowering benefit of drinking more water. So that's a rule of thumb on how much to drink. Some of you are asking me this question, and so we are going to talk about it. Is water from the tap okay? And this is a question that can be answered by one of my favorite words used in answering questions. Depends. Depends. Depends what's coming out of the tap. And actually, it's a good idea to have your water tested. and really see what's in it. Now, most municipal water sources are tested for certain basic things, but well, if you have a well, that's not usually regulated in most areas, and so no one has tested that water unless you have. And it's worth testing, because I know of people that, I'm thinking of a friend of mine who some years ago moved out into the country, into the pristine wilderness, drinking that nice well water. Turned out it was heavily contaminated with heavy metals. Family got very sick. So you should know what the quality of the water is that you're drinking. And some of the more effective ways to filter water would be reverse osmosis, and then distillation, especially if it's combined with a charcoal block. That will get out what we call volatile compounds that may just boil off with the, and end up in the distillate, in the water that's been distilled. A cheaper alternative that some people are using are these high-efficiency carbon blocks. Actually, I don't have any stock in the company, but we use something made by MultiPure, and it's pretty effective at getting a lot of stuff out of the water. It's not as good as some of those other methods, but there's no waste. So distillation, you know, there's an energy input, and with reverse osmosis, you're losing water because you're pushing it through this membrane, so there's water loss. So that's a greener option if your water is pretty good and you just want to filter it further. We told you yesterday that I'd go into some detail about caffeine. And although I mentioned some of this to you, we want to take some time in speaking about caffeine. It's a real concern. Many have developed a liking for caffeinated beverages. There's a time in my life where I used caffeinated beverages. And many people think they can't get by without them. It is a habit-forming compound. And these drinks actually worsen blood fluidity for a number of reasons. Caffeine does have diuretic effects, and so that is less than ideal for your water balance. Some people have said, well, it's not much of an effect, so you don't need to worry that much about it, but I think you should be concerned. But furthermore, there are other side effects of caffeine that worsen blood fluidity, and that's what we want to talk about. Caffeine physiology is actually fairly interesting. Unlike calcium, you absorb 99% of the caffeine that you ingest. Do you know what that figure is for calcium? That's right, it depends. And one of the things it depends on is where the calcium's from. Calcium in milk. So if you're drinking dairy products to get your calcium, and you feel that's important, you only absorb about 30% of the calcium from milk. So if you look on the side of the milk carton and it says 250 milligrams of calcium in a cup, you say, this is great. And there across from you is your mother-in-law, and she's eating her collards, her cooked collards. And you look it up and you say, the collards only have 220 milligrams of calcium per cup. So I'm getting more than you are. But then she says, no, being a wise mother-in-law, she says, no, the calcium in the green leafy vegetables is over 50% bioavailable. So I'm actually getting more than you. Would she be right? Yes, she would be. So you actually get more calcium from green leafy vegetables than you do, given the same amounts, than from milk. But caffeine is even more efficiently absorbed than that. 99% absorbed. This basically goes right into your bloodstream. And the most important mechanism for our discussion about brain health and blood fluidity has to do with this, and this is it's blocking adenosine receptors. So I want to speak some about these adenosine receptors. The adenosine receptors, I'm not going to go into a lot of biochemistry or physiology with you, but let's just make it simple. These things are throughout your body, these receptors. They are in the brain. They're in your heart. They're in your kidneys. They're in the fat tissue. That's a fancy name for fat tissue. They're in your intestinal system. So these are all over, these receptors. And when you take caffeine, it does what to those receptors? It blocks them. So let's look at what adenosine does. Adenosine is actually a good compound. So adenosine relaxes your blood vessels. It helps to lower blood pressure, for example. It makes your platelets, the clotting cells, less sticky. It blocks the stress hormones, as well as other things. Renin is involved with blood pressure. So, what's happening is adenosine is a good compound. Most of us would benefit by having more adenosine-related effects. And when you take the caffeine, it blocks it, the adenosine receptors. As a result, your platelets become more sticky, your stress hormones rise, and your blood pressure goes up. This, all of these things are worsening blood fluidity and circulatory performance. So you really are not ingesting a friend when it comes to your blood fluidity. Now, why would this be? Why would caffeine have these effects? Let me just try to make it as simple as I can for you. Caffeine, actually, what it's doing is it's stimulating the stress arm of your nervous system. Now, sometimes we may perceive that to be desirable. When would we think it's desirable to ramp up our stress system, if you will? When we're tired, right? This is one of the classic applications of caffeine. So you're tired, so what do? How many of you have learned that if you're tired, have you ever been falling asleep at the wheel, and then you wake up with one of those rumble strips, or wake up when you're just about to hit a deer or something like that? Did that ever happen to you? Then what happens? Then you're wide awake because you get this shot of adrenaline, right? Your stress hormones are activated. Or someone honks the horn because you're weaving or whatever. Hopefully you don't have too much experience with this. But having been a medical resident at one time in my life, I do have some experience. Anyway, the point is simply this. That's what the stress hormones do. They wake you up. They stimulate you for that fight or flight response. And if a bear is chasing you, you want your blood to coagulate more quickly. You might get injured, you see? You want your blood pressure to be higher to sustain more performance, and the stress hormone elevation is good. But what do most of us do when we drink the caffeine? We sit around, or we continue to sit at the wheel, or we go to work. And the point is, this is really not optimal for our physiology. It also actually interferes with something else that's a main cause of brain impairment, cognitive impairment, and that is sleep quality. It's surprising, but even caffeine relatively early in the day in sensitive people can impair sleep that night. So some of you might say, well, it doesn't bother me at all. I can have caffeine at supper time, and I can still go right to sleep. But your sleep quality and your sleep latency, your ability to fall asleep, may actually be impaired. You say, no, Dr. DeRose, I fall right to sleep. I fall asleep in just a few seconds. I guess I should tell you a little bit more about myself. Because when I first married my wife, I wasn't in residency. I was actually in practice, but I was very busy. And my wife was actually quite jealous because she said I would just put my head on the pillow and I would go to sleep. I thought this was an amazing talent that I had. What I later learned, even being a physician at the time, I didn't realize the significance of sleep latency. If you fall asleep immediately when your pillow hits head hits the pillow, or the pillow hits your head, whatever way you're doing it, you actually are showing evidence of sleep deprivation. Okay, this is not good. And if you say, well, Dr. DeRose, I sleep 9 hours every night, and I fall asleep right when I go to bed. Well, you may have sleep apnea or something else that's impairing your sleep quality. Because that's not normal. It's not normal to fall right asleep when you lay in bed. That's a sign of sleep deprivation. And so caffeine can interfere with that, but if you're really sleep deprived, even if you're drinking caffeine, you still can fall right to sleep. And I shared this with you the other day if you were here, and that is the caffeine. Apparently, Pavlov, we're still trying to find out from our Russian friends if Pavlov was really the one who first made this observation, that caffeine is bad habit glue. And actually, even if you look at people who are not from a Seventh-day Adventist persuasion and who are doing serious lifestyle interventions, they often exclude caffeine. How many of you have heard of Dean Ornish? Have any of you heard that name? Dean Ornish, back in 1990, published the first research showing that you could reverse blockages in heart arteries with lifestyle alone. When he put his patients on such a program, there was no caffeine allowed, zero. And I've not talked with Gene Ornish. I was at a conference that one of his colleagues gave. I didn't ask him this question. And that is, why did they exclude the caffeine? Was it because of some of these circulatory effects? Or was it because of the behavioral effects? We know that if you're trying to develop new behaviors, if you're drinking caffeine, caffeinated beverages, it makes it harder to develop new habits. Let me explain it this way. Habits in your brain are like roads. They're like pathways. Do any of you have any property where you have paths on it? Any of you have, like, some land that has some paths on it? Okay, some of you do. What happens if you stop walking on the path? It will get overgrown. But if you keep using it, that path stays wide open. Well, if you're trying to develop a new habit, let's say you've got a path going from, let's say here, stress to cigarette smoking. I know many of you can't relate to this, but it's over there, cigarette smoking. There's a path. Whenever you're under stress, you have a cigarette. And you want to develop a new habit. And that new habit you want to develop is exercising when you're under stress. And so exercise is represented by that door. Is there a pathway going from where I'm standing to that door? No, I have to, you know, crawl these seats and everything. And if it was a wooded area, over time, going over the brambles and the briars, it would beat them down and there'd be a path. But it takes a while for the other path to overgrow. And if you take in caffeine, it greases that path. It makes it easier to go down the other pathways. And they've known about this for years. For example, when you give typists caffeine, what happens to their typing speed? Do any of you know? It goes up. But what else goes up when they give them caffeine? Errors also go up. But what errors go up? The errors that go up are errors they used to make when they were learning to type. It actually resurrects some of these old pathways, apparently. There's some very interesting relationships with caffeine and behavior. So actually, these compounds, you know, caffeinated beverages are being recommended by many people, as are chocolate. You know, you think these were the new health foods in America. Let me just say, since I've mentioned chocolate here right now, you're going to see that it's a common migraine trigger along with the caffeinated beverages. But I've been a physician for over 30 years, and I have yet to have a patient in my office that I felt was there because of a lack of chocolate or caffeine. Okay, I'm just telling you. Just being honest with you. Okay, but these are common migraine triggers. So if you have migraine headaches, getting the caffeine and the chocolate and other things out of your lifestyle may get rid of the headaches. Here's the study that I mentioned yesterday. It was published just a couple of years ago. And this is the headline. This is right out of the Associated Press. Want to live longer? Drink coffee. Here's the actual study. Association of coffee drinking with total and all-cause specific mortality. They're in the New England Journal of Medicine, May 17th of 2012. And I told you about this study verbally, but I thought that, you know, actually seeing it might help it stick with you a little longer. This is right out of the study. So I'm reading the actual study. Here's what they say. In age-adjusted models, that means you're counting for the different ages of people, the risk of death was what? Increased among coffee drinkers. This is actually in the paper. And as I pointed out to you, what they did then is they used statistics to try to undo all the bad things that coffee drinking was associated with. That's right. They found in this study, which is, I believe, a study, and I didn't pull up the, I have a copy of the paper if any of you want to see it. I didn't look at it since we talked yesterday. But I think there's like a million person years represented in this study. It's a huge study. And what they found is that those who were drinking the coffee had worse lifestyles. They tended to eat worse. They tended to exercise less. They tended to be more overweight. And so when I'm reading this, I'm thinking, well, this sounds a lot like Pavlov. You know, that these people who are using more caffeinated beverages, they're having a harder time being on a healthier lifestyle. You know, Ellen White speaks about this. I'll show you. I think I threw a few statements in here. But she connects behavior with caffeine use and our ability to deal with certain even spiritual issues in our lives. And by the way, if you want to look it up, look up gossip in relation to coffee, and you'll find some interesting things. This is Councils on Diet and Foods, page 30. There are many among professed Christians today who would decide that Daniel was too particular and would pronounce him narrow and bigoted. They consider the matter of eating and drinking of too little consequence to require such a decided stand, one involving the probable sacrifice of every earthly advantage. I mean, Daniel was endangering his life, of course. But those who reason thus will find in the day of judgment that they turn from God's express requirements and set up their own opinion as a standard of right and wrong. There are moral implications, is the point, from our behavioral choices. We're not trying to make this into a salvation issue, as some of my peers in ministry say. We're not saved by how we eat. I mean, Jesus is our Savior, but our loving Savior tells us this is the way, walk ye in it. And if we don't want to heed that voice, there are consequences, and it can affect us morally as well. So how do we know? How do we know whether a lifestyle habit is healthy or not? We're speaking about beverages in particular. Well, you say, I just saw a study, Dr. DeRose. It said there was less Parkinson's disease in coffee drinkers. Well, so what do you do with that? Does that mean we should, because I know people have Parkinson's disease. By the way, did you know that smoking, there's some evidence that smoking can decrease certain neurodegenerative diseases? In fact, how many of you know that smoking, cigarette smoking, tobacco smoking, can decrease your risk of a serious inflammatory bowel disease called chronic ulcerative colitis? How many of you knew that? Even if you didn't know it, it's true. So how many of you are ready to, you know, run down to the drugstore and start smoking? It's a bad disease. You can get colon cancer. You can die from chronic ulcerative colitis. None of you want to get cigarettes. Well, maybe it's because you realize there are other problems associated with it. In fact, there's a potentially worse inflammatory bowel disease because it affects the entire intestinal system as opposed just to the colon, which is called Crohn's disease. Your risk of getting Crohn's disease is dramatically increased by tobacco smoking, as well as, you know, lung cancer and heart disease and Alzheimer's disease and a number of other things. So nobody is recommending smoking, even though it may help with certain conditions. That's what we were just talking about. So even if there's something beneficial in a product, we want to look at the big picture. And what I find amazing as a physician is that God often gave this life to Ellen White. You know, what things were just not beneficial in their entirety. And the research supports it if you look at the research broadly. So you want to choose things where benefits clearly outweigh the risks, and where do caffeinated beverages fit in? At least from my assessment and looking at the data, they're not there. They don't give us more benefit than risk if we look physically, spiritually, morally. How about this, alcohol? I mean, it's amazing. I mean, have you ever looked in the store? How much of store shelf space is taken up by alcohol? I mean, when I was a kid, grocery stores didn't sell alcoholic beverages. And now there's a big section in most grocery stores. So I know I'm maybe making some of you thirsty by showing you this. Hopefully not. I used to drink that stuff. Doesn't make me thirsty to see it now. This was another study I mentioned to you the other day. This is April 2011, the British Medical Journal. And there's been studies since that time that looked at this same relationship, and many studies before it. But they're looking in this paper about the risk of cancer in relation to alcohol use. Let me show you some of the key statements from the authors, both in the publication as well as in some of the press releases that came out with it. Let's look at some of their statements. The cancer risk increases with what? Every drink. So even moderate amounts of alcohol, such as a small drink each day, increases the risk of these cancers. There's a huge study. Again, this is EPIC, the European Prospective Investigation into Cancer and Nutrition. It's a multi-country study in Europe, one of the big, we call prospective epidemiologic studies in the world. Let's look at their next point. Now, this is very carefully worded, and I tried to explain this to you verbally, but you'll see it in print, and I'll try to help you understand what they're saying if it's not immediately apparent. Even though light to moderate alcohol consumption might decrease the risk for cardiovascular disease and mortality. So they're speaking about cardiovascular events like heart attacks and death from those. The net effect is harmful. And I'll explain this a little bit further. But the next bullet point, if you didn't, because that could be read a couple of different ways, they make it clearer here. Alcohol consumption should not be recommended to prevent cardiovascular disease or all-cause mortality. What they're saying here is simply this, and I'll give you a little bit more of the background, as I did yesterday. If you look at populations that have low rates of heart disease, like we see in the Oxford Vegetarian Study, and I don't think I snuck that in. I didn't. So the Oxford Vegetarian Study looked at who do you think was studied in the Oxford Vegetarian Study? Vegetarians, exactly right. People eating lots of fruits and vegetables. And when they looked at those people, they found that moderate drinking did not lower their risk of heart disease a bit, but increased the risk of all the other problems. And by the way, you know the problems with alcohol don't just relate to death and cancer death. It relates to a whole host of other things. Maybe I'll tell you a couple stories. You tell me what you think. A friend of mine now passed away. He was in the medical corps during World War II. He actually ended up becoming a brain scientist. But while he was in the medical corps, he was given an assignment. He said, "We've got a problem." His supervising officer said, "When the guys, you know, get a little bit of leave, many of them come back with sexually transmitted diseases. And this is impairing our, you know, capacity to be ready to take on the tasks that we need to. Can you find out, can you do an epidemiologic investigation, try to figure out what we can do to prevent the sexually transmitted diseases?" What do you think he found? The most predictable connection between an STD and, you know, having it or not was what? It was drinking. If they just had a little bit of alcohol, their risk of acquiring a sexually transmitted disease is dramatically increased. You say, "Well, Dr. Rose, that was years ago. I mean, it's not that kind of problem today. You know, the alcohol's better today." I had a physician some years ago, actually an Adventist physician, and many miles away, I'm sure none of you know him, and came into my office, and maybe he wasn't an Adventist, maybe he wasn't practicing at that time. I think he had an Adventist background. And he came in and he was seeing me for an HIV test. Why do you think he wanted an HIV test? He said, "I can't believe I did this." And the guy's a physician. He knows all these things. He says, "I was out, you know, I had something to drink. I met this girl and I don't know anything about her. I'm worried. You know, could I have gotten, you know, HIV infection?" Well, he was negative, but what was he telling me? He was saying, "I knew better, I shouldn't have done it," but he did what first? He drank. I could tell you about patients I've had who quit smoking. I remember one guy, he quit smoking for several years, and then he was at a party, and what do you think he was doing at the party? Just drinking a little bit, and then someone offered him a cigarette. He hadn't smoked for 2 years. So he said, "Well, I can have a cigarette. I'm not a smoker anymore." What do you think happened? He was right back to his old habit. Now, you say, "None of these things would happen to me, Dr. DeRose. I have a little bit of alcohol with my evening meal. I'm doing it for my heart's sake, and we enjoy it in our family." Well, I grew up in an Italian home. We weren't Seventh-day Adventists. We had alcohol around. Really, believe me, the research indicates it's not helping your heart if you're on a good lifestyle. And it's not doing anything else good for you. So in the cumulative, alcohol consumption shouldn't be recommended for heart health or to prevent all-cause mortality. It's just not your friend. Well, final statement on this. This was a comment from one of our National Institutes of Health researchers speaking about the same study, the British Medical Journal. He said, from a standpoint of cancer risk, the message of this report could not be clearer. There is no level of alcohol that can be considered safe. So this isn't, you know, a pastor in an Adventist church somewhere. I mean, these are health experts that are looking broadly at the data, and they're saying, I mean, the data is convincing. I'll tell you one other story. Some years ago, I've told many of you that one of my regular stops during the year is the American Public Health Association meetings, this big gathering of public health and preventive medicine experts from throughout the world. And one year, they did something interesting. I've not seen many debates in this venue, but they actually had one of the plenary sessions, one of the main sessions. I don't know that everyone was in that setting. I'm sure they weren't, 10 or 15,000 people. But in this prominent meeting, there was a debate going on between four experts. Two experts were taking the position that alcohol drinking in moderation was good for public health, and two were taking the position it was harmful. I found it interesting that the two that were saying it was good both had ties to the alcohol industry, and all they were talking about was the, quote, heart health benefits, which we've already seen. There are no benefits if you're already on an excellent lifestyle. Whereas the other two were going through this whole list of problems. I mean, are you aware of how many, you know, accidents, we call them unintentional injuries in the public health community, but unintentional injuries, accidents, homicides, suicides. You realize how many traumatic things happen in our society that are connected with alcohol? I mean, it's just huge. Drownings? I mean, it's huge. And if I told you, let's say it really did help lower your risk of heart disease. Let's say it lowered it 50%. And I said, there's this new pill. They put alcoholic beverages into a pill. It'll lower your risk of heart disease 50%, and just one problem, and that is that there's a percentage of people, depending on what statistics you use, 5%, 10%, maybe it's 20%, that are going to become addicted to this compound. It may ruin your family life, may cause you to lose your job. How many of you would say, well, boy, lower my heart disease risk 50%, it's worth it? How many of you would think that? You'd say, you're crazy, Dr. DeRose, I wouldn't take that. Here's the point I'm making. If there are people in your sphere of influence, even yourself, if you're drinking alcohol moderately and you like to do it and you don't think there's any moral reason you should avoid it, I think you're mistaken. But we live in a free country. You can do that. But don't deceive yourself and tell yourself you're doing something for your health. Okay? That's the point that I make to people. And I deal with people from across cultural and spiritual lines. I tell them, just don't fool yourself. If you want to drink alcohol, that's up to you. But it's not a health-giving beverage. Well, what about a healthy beverage? There's a beverage that, beside water, that everyone knows is healthy. Well, maybe not everyone. But you know what it is. It's juicing and smoothies, right? Well, are there any problems with this? Again, we've touched on some of this, but I want to give you some other data. One of the problems, you know, if you've been with me for a day or so, is that if you convert a whole food into a juice or a sauce or a smoothie or whatever, you will decrease the satiety per calorie. Now, this is good if you're very thin and having trouble maintaining your weight. And there's some of you in this room who maybe need to gain a little bit of weight. Sometimes we'll actually have someone drink a smoothie or a juice a half an hour before their meal, so that they get in some more calories. And what we find is when you drink those calories, it doesn't, the next meal, you don't eat that many calories less. So you actually do ingest more calories. So this could be helpful for you in that situation. But if you're trying to lose weight, this is not a good strategy. Because what are you going to do? You're going to get a lot of calories with relatively little satisfaction. So if you have a high metabolism, if you're doing a lot of exercise, these may be fine. They may be working great for you. I have friends who are, you know, fit and active, and they like their smoothies and things, and I have no burden to tell them they shouldn't use them. I'm just saying, I also see obese people come into my office, and they're drinking all this juice, and I'm just telling you, for most of them, it's actually not helping them. So, like we said, relatively low amount of satisfaction per calorie. Furthermore, when you take things in juice form or smoothies, they tend to raise the blood sugar more. And this is one that a lot of people don't realize, and we haven't talked about, one of the main reasons I'm sharing it with you now, is it can be harmful to your digestive physiology. Let's talk a little bit about this. This is research we've known about in the medical community for many years. It involves something called urogastrone. It's also known as epidermal growth factor. It's a compound that's made by these glands kind of under your jawbone here. Don't you call it in lay terms? The mandible? You have these glands down here, these submandibular glands, and they produce this compound. They produce it when you chew your food. So if you're drinking your food, how much urogastrone are you making? Not much. And the interesting thing about this compound is it's very important for intestinal health. For example, if you're prone to ulcers or gastritis, which is an irritation of the stomach lining, this compound will help to heal it. How many of you are aware that we have an epidemic in America of digestive lining problems? Are you aware of this? You've heard of GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. You've heard of gastritis. You've heard of ulcers. I wonder whether this is part of the problem. I'm not saying it's the whole problem. Some of those problems are caused by infection with a germ, a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. But this could well be contributing to some of the epidemic we have. These are some of the best-selling drugs we have in America, are these acid-blocking drugs. And many of us are trying to see how quickly we can ingest our calories. I mean, isn't this good, Dr. DeRose? I only spend 5 minutes now at breakfast, and I get, 15 fruits because I drink them all down. Well, I'm just telling you, this isn't the ideal way to ingest your calories. Someone else knew about this, and I thought I even snuck this slide in for you. I was really thinking about you guys. I've been adding slides that go along with what we've been talking about. And no, I don't think I have it here. I'm just trying to see if I put it in and hid the slide. But I didn't. Ellen White actually speaks about soft foods and foods that we don't have to chew not being optimal for our digestive health. So I think it's very interesting in light of what we know about the physiology of chewing and these healing compounds. Well, let's continue, because we're trying to speak about brain health, and we're looking at the blood fluidity angle, and we're going to talk to us some about eating more plant foods. And what I've been doing is kind of augmenting this talk with some of the things you've been talking with me about, questions you've been asking, and so we'll sneak some of those things in here as well. How many of you have been in a health food store recently? Any of you? Okay. Some of the best sellers in health food stores are actually compounds like lycopene and resveratrol, zeaxanthin, lutein. You know what all these things are called collectively? They're called phytochemicals. Many people are buying these, taking them as supplements, because research is showing that these things are health-enhancing. And so people are going in to the health food store, buying these and taking them in large amounts. So phytochemicals are actually not essential for life, but they help to optimize life's quality. They enhance health. So things that are necessary for life would be vitamins and essential minerals. So vitamins you have to have or you will die. You'll develop deficiency syndromes and die. Whereas phytochemicals are not necessary for life, but they enhance health. Here's a partial listing of some phytochemicals. There have been at least 8,000 phytochemicals identified. So you can see this is a very partial listing. These are some of the ones that may be more familiar to you, and they may not be. Let me just give you some examples how this would help brain health and blood fluidity. Let me give you some examples. Here's the first one, the anthocyanins. Good sources, red apples, grapes, berries, cherries, tomatoes, onion, and garlic. Now, I've told some of you, in fact, all of you in this room, some about my ethnic heritage. How many of you actually picked up on it? Italian. Three of my grandparents were born in Italy. Now, I'm thinking of my mother's father. He was born in Sicily. And he died in his 90s. But I'm convinced he never heard of anthocyanin. So therefore, he got no benefit from them. Well, he obviously never went to the health food store and bought anthocyanin. Why are you so sure that he got benefit from anthocyanin? Yes, because being a good Sicilian, he ate lots of tomatoes and grapes and onions and garlic. He was getting lots of anthocyanins. Why I tell you that is because many phytochemicals have not been identified. The experts estimate there are probably twice as many phytochemicals that have not been identified as those that have. Now, don't ask me how people can estimate how many things they don't know are out there. Okay? I haven't quite figured that out. But the point is, there's lots of these phytochemicals. If you want to be on the cutting edge of phytochemicals, what should you do? You should eat whole plant foods. That's right. Eat more fruits and vegetables. If you're waiting for someone to discover it and then go to the health food store, you're already behind the times. So my grandfather was getting benefits from all these things, even though he never heard of anthocyanin and may never have even walked into a health food store. What do anthocyanins do? Well, they do things that help with brain health through a number of mechanisms, as well as helping with other things. They relax blood vessels. When blood vessels relax, circulation improves. They have antioxidant properties. Many people believe that oxidation is at the root of many of our neurodegenerative diseases, like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, at least in part, and so would have benefits in that regard. It's anti-inflammatory, and it activates cartilage repair. So if you have osteoarthritis, you should be trying to find ways to eat more apples and onions and garlic. By the way, it'll decrease your risk of infections, too. Garlic has known anti-infective properties. And even if that's just all a bunch of hype, I know if you eat lots of garlic, it'll keep people away from you, so you'll be less likely to get something transmitted from someone else. Cancer preventive anthocyanins are, and it's true of lung cancer, lymph gland cancer that we call lymphoma, ovarian cancer, and gastric or stomach cancer. Here's another phytochemical, curcumin. These are actually, this is turmeric illustrated right here, and turmeric, a good source of curcumin. Curcumin is a very interesting compound, and it has brain health implications. We mentioned this, it may have been informally after my lecture. It actually is one of the compounds that is being suggested as possibly protecting us from some of these neurodegenerative diseases. The reason is that curcumin has properties of heavy metal chelation. Chelation actually comes from a term that refers to the claws of a crab. And a chelator grabs onto things like the claws of a crab and removes them from the body. So the research indicates, and we'll talk more about this in this series on brain health. I have some more material on heavy metals and brain health. But real evidence that these are connected, and turmeric, the active agent being curcumin, may potentially help protect you from some of these conditions. The curcumin also decreases platelet stickiness. It's anti-inflammatory. And for this reason, sometimes people with arthritis, I'll recommend this as a natural anti-inflammatory. Instead of taking a pill, recommend curcumin. By the way, the common anti-inflammatory drugs have a serious detrimental brain health impairing connection. Do any of you know what it is? One of the leading risk factors for impairment in brain function over time is actually high blood pressure. And the common over-the-counter and prescription anti-inflammatory drugs actually raise blood pressure. And people with high blood pressure, those drugs, by actual study, can raise systolic blood pressure as much as 15 points. So it's a significant factor. In fact, a recent review looking at this topic said, in so many words, that anyone who has high blood pressure should try to avoid these drugs. Well, what do you do then? One of the things you should consider is curcumin or turmeric, and we'll find also another brain health-enhancing compound that also fights inflammation. We'll talk about it later in this series. That's the omega-3 fats. Omega-3 fats also are anti-inflammatory and good for brain function. So that'll come up later in this five-part series. Ferulic acid. How many of you knew that you were eating ferulic acid when you had the oatmeal this morning? Yes, you got ferulic acid. Well, what good was that? Well, it has antioxidant properties, can help prevent diabetes and its complications. By the way, diabetes is a leading cause of mental health impairment. Fluctuation in blood sugar can have long-term implications on your brain health. So normalizing blood sugar is desirable. Anti-cancer properties as well. We could go through a whole list of phytochemicals. We're not going to do that. But the whole point is many of these things help to prevent against age-related nerve deterioration as well as other problems. Let's put this all together with the last few slides. And we're going to look at some cumulative things. I told you about this slide yesterday, so I wanted to actually show it to you. From the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, now about 5 years ago, May of 2009. This is from AHS2, Adventist Health Study, the current version. And this is looking at Seventh-day Adventists and their dietary practices and their likelihood of having high blood pressure or diabetes. And what I want you to notice is even if you're a Seventh-day Adventist, if you're living like the average American, eating like the average American, you have the highest risk among Adventists of both diabetes and high blood pressure. These are these bars on the far left. If you're a semi-vegetarian, I've noticed that most semi-vegetarians tell me they're essentially a vegetarian. They're eating red meat, poultry, and fish less than once a week. Did it help them? Yes, it lowered the risk of diabetes, what, over 20%? Similar for the high blood pressure, hypertension. But still much higher than if they got rid of all the meat and poultry and were just using fish and dairy and eggs. That's a pesco vegetarian. They're down here in this bar. But if you get rid of the fish, you're a lacto-ovo vegetarian. You're down to about 40% the risk of diabetes and high blood pressure. And if you become a vegan, you have the very lowest risk of diabetes and hypertension. And you still can get it. I mean, some people are very genetically predisposed. But the point is, the more you eat whole plant foods, the lower your risk of these conditions. And both diabetes and high blood pressure are major causes of brain impairment over time. Major causes. Well, this is heart disease mortality. This is also from the Adventist Health Study, the other older version of it. And kind of a similar picture, lowest risk of, now this is death from heart attack, was in the vegans. Vegetarians better off than the non-vegetarians. All the Adventists better off than the non-Adventists. So you can just be confident that you're an Adventist, you're lowering your risk. But you can lower it more by being more circumspect. This is actually from some of the Harvard data set. And I pulled this out of another presentation that I have. So I see that some of the formatting got messed up a little bit. But the point here is you're looking at increasing amount of red meat consumption in relation to colon cancer. So it's not just true for brain health. You eat more red meat, your risk of colon cancer increases. By the way, the same data from the physician's health study and the nurse's health study published a couple of years ago in the American Journal of Medicine. Just what we call a dose-response relationship. I mean, the same kind of linear relationship. Looking at meat consumption and all-cause mortality. So the more meat you eat, the more likely you are to die sooner. And this is, in fact, there's an editorial. This is a secular medical journal. I think the editorial, if I'm not mistaken, was written by Dean Ornish. But the question was, should we all just stop eating red meat? Well, that was a few years ago, and I still see that they've got red meat in the supermarkets, right? And some of you may still have it. I grew up eating red meat. But the Lord can help you develop new habits. Have you heard that before? By the way, if you haven't heard that, that's the whole subject of my series, Changing Bad Habits for Good. We're not presenting that at Camp Meeting, but we do have a DVD here, Changing Bad Habits for Good. The message is, you don't have to live a miserable life. You change your lifestyle and stick with it, you can develop new enjoyment. So God isn't trying to make your life miserable, He's trying to add quality. One last study that kind of integrates some of the things we've been talking about diet before we finish up, and that's this one here, again from the Adventist Health Study, showing more frequent consumers of three categories of foods compared with less frequent consumers, looking at the risk of probably the most devastating of cancers, which is pancreatic cancer. You know, people measure survival with pancreatic cancer in weeks, usually, as opposed to months or years. You can see here more meat, poultry, and fish. These are people eating those things three or more times a week. They have over double the risk of pancreatic cancer as those who are eating these foods seldom. Eggs are even worse. So frequent egg consumption, this isn't huge amounts of eggs, just three or more times a week, over triple the risk of pancreatic cancer. And then here's the good thing. If you're eating lots of beans, lentils, and peas, your risk is hardly detectable. You could still get pancreatic cancer, but very low risk compared to those seldom eating those beans. Well, we covered a number of things. We'll actually continue on the subject of blood fluidity and brain health, but we've got a lot more things. We're going to talk about boosting tryptophan levels in the brain and tyrosine and how you can do that with lifestyle. We'll be speaking about the omega-3 fats and stroke prevention. So a lot of things coming up over the next 4 days. Well, we need to finish up, so let's close with a word of prayer. We'll have more time for questions and answers in other sections of this series. Father in heaven, the more I study the medical science, the more I see that you've allowed light to shine on our path to help us avoid mental health problems, to help us have clearer minds so that we can hear your voice more clearly, to have clearer minds so that we can read the Bible and understand it better, and that we can share these things with our neighbors, with our family members. Please help us to really see these things in this light. It's not that you're trying to take anything away from us. You're trying to enhance our lives, to bless us and make us a blessing. We thank you for all this in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.